Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi. Today on The Wildlife, I'll be joined by Brian Christie, author of The Lizard King, and also the January 2010 article in National Geographic called The Kingpin on Asia's Wildlife Trade. We'll talk about the illicit reptile trade and also his adventures in researching this underworld. But first, let me play you today's creature call. This week's creature call is an endangered reptile that comes from Indonesia. It's the largest living species of lizard, which can grow up to 10 feet in length. Now listen carefully and see if you can guess today's creature call. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again, tell you what kind of animal made them, and also give you a preview of next week's creature call. Now, let me turn to my conversation with Brian Christie on the illegal reptile trade. Brian Christie is an investigative journalist and author. He is a graduate of Pennsylvania State University, Cornell, University of Michigan Law School, and was a Fulbright Scholar to the University of Tokyo Law School. His most recent story, The Kingpin, profiled illegal wildlife trader Anson Wong for the January 2010 issue of National Geographic magazine. Before becoming a journalist, Brian was a lawyer in Washington, D.C., specializing in international trade law and policy. He worked on such issues as U.S.-Japan supercomputer negotiations, Norwegian whaling, and sales of light-water nuclear reactors to North Korea. He also worked in the Executive Office of the President. Mr. Christie is also the author of The Lizard King, The True Crimes and Passions of the World's Greatest Reptile Smugglers. In researching that book, he was bitten between the eyes by a blood python, chased by a mother alligator, sprayed by a bird-eating tarantula, and ejaculated on by a Bengal tiger. When we spoke recently, I asked Brian what first got him interested in reptiles.
I grew up in southern New Jersey, in a sort of farm country, and on my street, we traded frogs and turtles and lizards the way city kids trade baseball cards and Hot Wheel cars, I guess.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we spent, a Saturday, as soon as school was out in the afternoon or Saturday mornings, there was a little gang of us that were like the little rascals or something, and we would run out into the woods and we had our favorite tree with a hole in the bottom that the turtles would soak in, and we had, you know, the favorite frog spot, and you'd catch what you could and bring it back and then trade it. So a couple of leopard frogs might get you a box turtle, and a couple of box turtles might get you a fence swift or another lizard, but nothing could get you a snake. If you had a snake in that world, you were the king.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you begged your... I brought a king snake to school, which is about 5 feet long, in second grade, in a pillowcase. And I think that's what changed my life. The whole school came to see what was in the pillowcase, you know, and the principal called me down to his office, and then...
And did not expel you at this point.
Did not expel me, no. The only time I got to see behind what was behind that door without getting yelled at. Yeah. And then one teacher ran out of the building. So that, you know, that was love forever after that.
Huh. And so was it any kind of snake or just the more exotic kinds of snake? What is a king snake?
A king snake is a pretty common constrictor. They're pretty widespread throughout the United States. They get about 5 feet long. They're black, mostly black with sort of a white chain along their back. And in New Jersey, it's the largest snake. So, you know, you started out as kids trying to catch garter snakes or finding little snakes in the woods. But a king snake was a pretty big deal, mostly because of how large it was, and also because they're pretty gentle. So you could grab one and not really be afraid it was going to bite you.
And did you know this when you first encountered the snake?
Yeah, I read. I was the snake boy, so I got all the Peterson Field guides and for birthdays and Christmases, all I wanted were snake books and then pet shop snakes if I could convince my parents to take me to the pet store. Yeah.
So then how did that translate into investigating this case that your book, The Lizard King, focuses on? How did you first find out about this case?
So let's see how many years later that would be. That would be a many years later. I continued with my snake passion up to the first day of college when my father said, look, Brian, you've got a Burmese python that's, I don't know, 12 or 15 feet long, and you can't take that to school with you, and your mother and I have decided you can't leave it with us. So, he found a school principal to take the snake, and that was pretty much the end of my reptile life for 15 years or so. I went to law school and really tried to. I was in some kind of race to be a professional, to be a grown up as fast as possible. And what I didn't realize is I really still cared about snakes, and I really. And when you put down a passion for I don't know, society, when you're trying to grow up for other people and not for yourself, you put down more than your snake. You put down your ability to be passionate about things. And when I went to law school, again, to be an adult and responsible. And I was about 15 years into that life, and I said, you know, that's not who I was, and that's not what I cared about. And I enjoyed writing, and I enjoyed wildlife, and I left my law firm, and I was on vacation driving to South Florida. I had started as a journalist by that point, and I got a phone call from Playboy magazine, and the editor said, how's the reptile smuggling story going? And I had no idea what he was talking about. But as a freelancer, you get kind of quick on your feet. And I said, oh, it's going great. And he said, oh, so tell me about it. Now, I had just done a story for Playboy on coin smuggling. And apparently, this guy was a new editor, and apparently he confused his wires and thought I was doing a reptile smuggling story. So he said, so tell me about it. So I remember, I brought up stuff I knew from being a kid. I said, well, you know, there are these guys that have venomous reptiles, and they sell them, buy and sell them at these things called hot shows. Hot is slang for venomous. And you can go to, even today, there's a little town in Pennsylvania Dutch country called Hamburg, Pennsylvania. There's a hot show there, and you can buy a spitting cobra or a Mozambique cobra. You can buy mambas there from Africa, all in this little town, you know, for $100. And he said, okay. And I said, oh, and there's this other thing. There's this new designer reptile world where they isolated genes for color and pattern in reptiles, and they're designing genetically snakes, taking brown and black snakes and turning them striped, yellow and white, turning them into yellow and white striped snakes, and giving them these crazy names like Killer Bumblebee and Platy Daddy and Dreamsicle. I said, it's just like the hot rod car era of the 50s, but they're doing it with genes today. And he said, yeah, Brian, you know, that's interesting, but I'm looking for crime. There's crime in this, right? And I didn't know. I knew there were some criminal elements in the reptile world, but I didn't know much. I said, sure, there's crime in this. this is an animal planet we're talking about. And he said, so who's our main criminal? And again, I'm on my cell phone driving my truck. And
is this when you pretended it went out?
Exactly.
Really?
Yeah, exactly. He said, who's your main guy? I said, I took the phone away from my ear and I hung up. And I drove to the federal courthouse in Orlando, and I started looking up reptile smuggling cases. And it turned out, luck was with me, because in the United States, South Florida is ground zero for wildlife trafficking in general, historically. And in the reptile world, it is by far, that in fact, outside of Florida, they refer to the reptile dealers as the South Florida Mafia, because they've been connected to not only reptile trafficking, but also gun and drug trafficking, and even murder. And I found one case that had all of that connected to it, and that became the focus of the Lizard King.
Really? So then, did an article on reptile smuggling appear in Playboy?
They never did. There was a little bit of turmoil with that editor, and I think he was let go. He was sort of a short-termer. And in the interim, I learned some things about the main character, Mike Van Ostrand, and his relationship to the agent that investigated him. That said to me, this is more than a reptile story. This is a really important story, a human story, and I really wanted to tell it. And so I didn't even push to, in part because I didn't want to lose any rights to the story in book form. I didn't push very hard with Playboy, and I just went off on my own and wrote it myself as a book.
So tell me a little bit about the book, The Lizard King, especially for people who haven't read it.
Sure. It's the story, it's basically the story of two men. It's the story of a reptile smuggler, a dealer named Mike Van Ostrand, who owns a company called Strictly Reptiles. And Strictly Reptiles is considered the world's largest reptile import-export company. If you've seen a reptile in a pet shop in the last 20 years, chances are pretty good it came from Strictly Reptiles or can be connected to Strictly Reptiles.
Really? It has that big of a reach?
Oh, they're massive, especially in the big year. More people are into reptiles now, but especially in the late 80s and early 90s, in their peak years, they were bringing in, and they're still in very, they're still a dominant player today, the dominant player. But in their peak import years of iguanas, for example, they were bringing in 300,000 iguanas a year. So if you saw one in a pet shop, it's a little over half, I think, of the imports in the United States. So you had a one in two shot if you're looking at a green iguana in a pet shop that came from Strictly Reptiles.
Really? Over half of the market?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Their facility is massive. It's a city block. It was originally a Frito-Lay warehouse. It has a couple of loading bays. It's surrounded by barbed wire fence, and it's got one-way mirrors and cameras throughout the building and the outside, and it's quite large.
Now you went to work there?
Eventually, yeah. So just to round out the story, during the 1990s, Strictly was not only this legal, massive legal entity, but it was also what I call the brains and bank behind a global syndicate smuggling rare reptiles and protected reptiles. And so the story is the story of Mike Van Ostrand and his dad, who have the business, and a special agent from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service named Chip Bepler, who says, wow, he was in New York, and he said, wow, there's a lot of animals coming through the port of New York headed to this company called Strictly Reptiles. And what he realized was reptiles were this unrecognized, exploited form of wildlife, and that all sorts of smugglers were sort of keying off the success of Strictly to smuggle other forms of wildlife, so rare birds and fish and things. And so he and his wife moved from New York to Florida to go after the Van Ostrands.
They moved just to related to this case.
That's right. That was their professional reason. Yeah, he wanted to focus on that case and go after Van Ostrand. And in the sort of amusing coincidence, they moved to virtually the same street, so that it was very much a sheepdog and coyote sort of scenario where the Bepplers were a couple miles away, but it was pretty much the same street. So if they went to the beach, they drove past the Van Ostrand's house and past Strictly Reptiles operation, and vice versa.
Wow. And who is the Lizard King? It's Mike or his dad, Ray, or it's the business?
To me, their catchphrase was strictly reptiles, the iguana kings, because particularly in when they got started in the 80s, iguanas were the bread and butter form of reptiles. You know, every pet shop in the country could be counted on to have a couple of iguanas, and iguanas make horrible pets.
Oh, really?
They're among the worst things you could possibly buy. They grow to an enormous size. They take a huge amount of room. They basically, to be cared for well, they take a small bedroom in terms of space, and they have UV light requirements and demand a varied diet and calcium supplements. And I'd say 8 out of 10 die the first year, and the other two, almost always are poorly cared for. It's really amazing just that they're so widely sold, but they're called in the pet industry trash pets, and trash pets are the pets that every pet store has. It's kind of stock. They don't care if they die. They're $10 or less to buy, and they're sort of a staple. So I took the Lizard King as a sort of play on the Iguana King's moniker that they use.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. And then just how does the reptile trade work, or the pet reptile trade work? Where was Strictly Reptiles selling and buying from, selling to and buying from?
Well, Strictly is an international wholesaler and import-exporter. So they imported from all over the world. I worked there for a while, and they were really generous with their time and let me, even when I wasn't working there, I could pop in at any time during the year. And I spent 3 years researching the book, and I would drop in without notice at any time during those 3 years. And they would let me sit in the office, and I literally sat on the floor from morning till night for weeks at a time. And so I got to see where all their stuff came from. And you can't name a country where reptiles or amphibians exist that they weren't doing business with. At least I couldn't come up with one. And they sell likewise to any pet store chain in the United States or around the world. Likewise to zoos and museums and individual collectors.
How did you go about researching the book? You said you spent 3 years researching the book.
I started out in court records. There was a couple of criminal cases. Ray Van Ostrand, as Mike's father, had been involved in a major narcotics case. There was a family in Miami called the Tabrawi family, and it was considered by prosecutors to be a $100 million cocaine and marijuana trafficking operation, and they were dealing in guns, and they had found an ATF informant in at one point, and a couple of the organization's men shot the informant in the head, and then the head of the organization, Mario Tabrawi, according to testimony, took a circular saw and sawed the man's head off and his arms and legs and burned the body in a horse trough. And Ray Van Ostrand was a gun, he moved guns connected to that organization, but the organization also had an exotics animal aspect, and Ray was in charge of the reptile division of that business for a while. And so there was a lot of court record. Mario had been sentenced to 100 years in prison, although he's out now, and I went to see him as part of the book at his home. And many of the players had criminal court cases, and so I spent really weeks in various federal courthouses researching that. When I felt like I knew a good deal, then I went to Strictly Reptiles and told them who I was and that I wanted to interview them and they about the reptile world. And Mike Van Ostrand said, you know, we don't really talk to the press here. And I said, you know, this is what we were in the warehouse, and I said, you know, this is like Disney World to me, looking around. And really, I mean, there were hundreds of species in cages in this room, and it really was like the best thing I had going for me was that I truly was as happy as could be in this room with all these snakes and lizards and turtles and things. And then I also said, look, you know, if I wanted to slam you, he had been slammed in the media, he said several times, it would be easy to slam anybody based on that court record. I wanted to try to find the human side of the story. And it took a long time. It took a few years of, there was a lot of doubt whether I was who I said I was, whether I was an undercover agent, for example, or something like that. And a lot of people in the reptile world accused me of being a federal agent or something. And it took a long time to get past that. But eventually I did, and, you know, people trusted me with their story, and I'm really pleased.
I think that's one thing that really sets The Lizard King apart from other books or anything, is that it really is a human side of a story, and it doesn't vilify anybody in it, the smugglers or people involved in the trade.
Thank you. Yeah, I worked really hard on that. You know, I grew up in a funeral home, and when you do that, you see, when you grow up seeing people alive one minute and gone the next, and you see families experience the end of life, I think that has made me very aware that we are all human, that we, even the best of us make mistakes, and the worst of us have some good aspects. And I tried to follow the maze through that. And for example, Mike Van Ostrand, who's the villain technically in the story, when you spend enough time with him, you realize there's this incredibly tragic and also honorable story to be told. And so I was really pleased I had to. If I hadn't gotten to the point of seeing that, then I never would have written the book, because you know, the world doesn't need another story about how sad the state of wildlife is and how there's nobody good in the world to do anything about it.
And what was his reaction to the finished product?
I was worried about that. You know, I really, I say, you know, I came to respect his character and things, but I also didn't pull any punches. I told exactly the story as I understood it, and exactly the misdeeds that he committed, and my impression of what his character is and things. So I didn't know how he would take it. And he said, "You did a good job." And he since has given interviews where he said he got it right. And that means a lot to me. I certainly... not a flattering portrait in many ways, so I don't mean I was co-opted in any way, and I don't mean I was looking for his approval, but he has a strong character, and if I weren't accurate, if I took cheap shots, he would have told me.
I think this might be the only book where you took the time to research that side and get to know the smuggler.
Yeah, I really thought that, you know, I read tons of writing on wildlife crime, and most of that writing either focuses on the wildlife and misses the law enforcement or the bad guy, or focuses on just the good guy and the wildlife. But nobody that I had read to that point had spent time with the smuggler. And I had recently read a book called Snowblind by Sebag about a cocaine trafficker out of Colombia, and the author, that book was phenomenal, I thought. He spent time with this trafficker out of Colombia, who was an American, and I thought, oh yeah, that perspective where you get the inside perspective is really something. And it took, three times longer than I wanted it to, but I was pleased with the result.
So tell me about some of the adventures you had researching the book. I know, so you worked, how did you come to work at Strictly Reptiles?
Well, so Mike's dad works there in the front office, and I was, as I say, sitting on the floor every day, and they have lots of work to do. And I think, I'll spare you the language, but I think it was, hey, instead of sitting around, why don't you pick up a broom? And so I started with a broom, and then he said, hey, do an inventory of the snake room. So I inventoried the snake room, and I just became, to be honest, they have several snake rooms, and one room was North American snakes, and I really kind of took ownership or felt ownership of that room. I wanted it to be, spotless, and so I fed those animals, and I arranged the cages the way I thought they should be arranged. And there were, probably 2,000 snakes in that room, or it was a lot anyway. And so it struck a chord with me that harkened back to my childhood. I really felt like a kid again, and it was something I hadn't expected at all. And so I was happy as a clam, and I didn't take any money. The way the deal I said struck was, look, I'll come to work, and I'll do the work, but as payment, you have to sit down with me once or twice a week for lunch and talk about your life. And that was the deal.
Wow, that's amazing. I assume, no doubt, they could see the love of the animals that you had, just like they had.
Yeah, but Mike, okay, so there's a couple of things to say about that. One, I don't think Mike has, he likes animals, but he'll be the first to say he doesn't love them. He inherited this business more or less, so I think if he could have been in a different business, he would have preferred it. There's a lot of stress about the animal business, and no one thinks well of the animal business, and I think it's a burden that they carry around. People like to have their pet turtle or lizard at home, many people, but they don't realize that the people who do that business on a commercial scale, get a lot of grief from the rest of the world, and in many cases that's deserved. I've always had a lizard or something, and I wouldn't have those animals if it weren't for some of those commercial scale guys. So I don't know that they love them particularly. Ray does, his dad does. And as for my love, I said, I do. If I were a kid, I'd work for free. He said, yeah, we get a lot of you guys coming in here saying you work for free. And after a week of getting bitten and having things, crap on you or whatever, and that sort of spirit goes away, and people show up asking for the paycheck.
And were you bitten or crapped on or
Yeah, I had the whole
otherwise
gamut.
molested?
Yeah, I was bitten there a few times. And then, of course, so there's two things. One is I'm addicted to pet shops. So in my whole life, and I've traveled all over the world, I have never seen a pet shop I haven't gone into anywhere. If I see a pet shop, I go into it. I don't really know why. Researching the book, I went into pet shops all over the United States and reptile dealerships and things. In one place, I asked to see a blood python, and the guy brought one out. And I hadn't seen a blood python since I was a little kid. And
So what is a blood python?
A blood python, the blood, I think, comes from the coloration. They're kind of red in color. They're from Muslim or from Indonesia, and they get about 6 feet long, but they're incredibly fat animals. So they're about as big around as a man's thigh, I guess.
Really? That huge?
Yeah, they're quite. They're amazingly fat for their length, and they're notoriously aggressive from the wild. And when I was a boy, all the blood pythons you saw were from the wild. So I'd had one attack my little brother when we were at a pet shop one time, and that was the last one I saw. So I go to this pet shop and I said, "Do you have any blood pythons?" And he brings one out and he puts it on my arm, and I'm trying to remember back. To blood pythons, and I'm thinking, oh yeah, they're supposed to be very mean. And I say to the guy, "Hey, aren't these supposed to?" And wham! It bites me right between the eyes. Yeah.
Are they venomous?
No, they're not venomous, but they've got a lot of teeth. And the thing that saved me was I was wearing sunglasses, and it hit the bar of my sunglasses, so I was bleeding there. But it could have been a lot worse. And the lesson was, and I'd forgotten this because it had been, as I say, 20 years since I'd fooled around with snakes, is that not all snakes strike the same way. The classic image is it coils back like a spring and then straightens out. But blood pythons just sort of throw their bodies, and they don't really recoil. So you don't. I didn't know it was coming before it came, and anyway, that was one of my adventures.
Well, and you kept at
I did. Yeah, I love that. You know what I love? One of my favorite things was, as a boy, I caught lots of snakes, but I was always afraid of being bitten, so I was always really careful about how I caught them. And when I met these snake guys, they don't care at all. They get bitten all the time. And the first time I was bitten as an adult, I saw that, hey, you know what? It doesn't really hurt. And there is some blood, depending on the species. But once I realized that, then I could grab stuff willy-nilly, as we say. And now, it doesn't work with all. I did that with an Asian rat snake, and they actually have some very long teeth. And that was a bad move. But in general, you don't really have to be afraid that they'll bite you. It really doesn't hurt that much.
Really?
Yeah, for most snakes, up to a certain size.
I still have a healthy
Yeah.
fear or respect.
That's okay. That's normal.
And what about other animals? Have you had up close encounters with other, like alligators or
You really want me to tell the story
I
for
do. But if you don't want to, it's okay too.
All right,
Well,
so.
I've always been curious.
Right, to sell the book or to get a publisher interested, I put some of my adventures in the publicity or the proposal. And when my editor, Jonathan Karp, read that section of my proposal, he said, "You have to. This is fantastic. You have to include what you've experienced in every reference to yourself." So for a while, anywhere you saw my name, you saw Brian Christie was bitten between the eyes by a blood python, chased by a mother alligator, sprayed by a bird-eating tarantula, and ejaculated on by a Bengal tiger. And that's all true. As a result of that little phrase, I have been asked in public at some prestigious events, like the Academy of Sciences in Malaysia, where they told me before they introduced me that they've only had Nobel laureates speak prior to me. And then somebody asked, "So you were ejaculated on by a Bengal tiger?" So that event occurred.
Because I mean, it really makes one curious how you possibly got ejaculated on by a Bengal tiger.
Right.
I don't doubt it, but.
So I went to Mario Tabrawi was the man convicted of narcotics trafficking, and according to many people, he was the basis for Scarface, the Tony Montana character in the movie Scarface. And he had the big mansion and the machine guns and the whole army of people and the it's a fascinating story. And I'm told actually that Mario, when he signs his copy of The Lizard Kings, it writes the original Scarface when he autographs it now for people.
Oh, really?
But anyway, I went to see Mario. Mario got out of prison. He was sentenced to 100 years, but they let him out after cooperating, I think, in a couple of cases. And he lives outside of Miami now, and he has an exotic animal business. And on his property, he has primate or monkeys and a lot of strange animals, including tigers. And his assistant gave me a tour of the property, and we're walking around, and we're looking at he has some attack dogs and interesting birds and things. We get to the tiger cage, which is not a cage, it's like a fenced yard kind of thing. And my tour guide starts calling to the tigers, and they come over, and he reaches through the bars and pets the tiger. And I thought, well, wow, that's pretty brave. And I had just seen this video about a woman in London who went up to a tiger cage, and she was looking, she was very close to the bars, and the tiger, she's looking at the tiger's head, and the tiger reaches its paw at the bottom of the cage and hooks her foot. And did you see this video?
No.
And hooks her foot and pulls her leg into the cage and starts eating her leg right there, and there's at the zoo, and there's nothing she can do about it. So I'm thinking about that as the kid is scratching the tiger. And I think, wow, that's really crazy. And then I thought, well, you're a journalist. You're supposed to be experiencing, if this kid can do it, why don't you do it? So I stuck my hand through the bars, the fence, and started petting the tiger, keeping an eye on the front end of the tiger. And the kid says, "Look out!" And I turn, and the tiger's head seems to be where it's supposed to be. Anyway, the tigers spray like a, it's not just urine, it's a marking thing, you know, the way cats do, but on a tiger scale. And this tiger sprayed me in the chest. And George Schaller has written about the potency of this marking chemical, and how a month later, a tiger can recognize that scent and will avoid a tree marked like that. So that was the verb ejaculate. I learned could cover all forms of fluid emitted in that way. So
My dog's been sprayed by a skunk, and it lasted for months.
right.
So did you have that same issue?
Well, it's worse than that because this tour was before I did the interview. And in fact, it's even worse than that. So I'm covered with this tiger spray, and I go in. They have a little kitchen there in Mario's office, and I'm wiping my shirt off with paper towels. And Mario's on the phone. So I'm like, oh man, this is horrible. And but he's on the phone for a while, and I look over, and he has a monkey, I think it was a gibbon, in a cage in the anteroom to his office. And I'm thinking, oh, you know, look at the monkey. And I kind of put my hand near the cage, but not in the cage. Well, it turns out the cage door is unlocked, and the monkey throws open the cage door and runs up my hand, up my arm, and around my neck, and grabs me behind the head with all four legs.
Oh my
and
gosh.
it's locked on the back of my head. So
no
I
doubt
have...
attracted by the tiger spray.
Who knows? But you know, looking back on it, so I'm about to interview this highly wanted individual at one time. I've got tiger spray all over my shirt and literally a monkey on my back. And they had to bring in somebody to pull the monkey off of me.
Oh,
so
really?
Yeah.
And were you hurt at all or no?
Oh, no. It was fine. But, yeah, so to say I had a few adventures during the story is an understatement.
You recently wrote in the January 2010 edition of National Geographic an article called The Kingpin about the Asian, the illegal Asian wildlife trade. And it was focused on a guy named Anson Wong. How did you first hear about Anson Wong?
Anson Wong is considered by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service set up a sting operation in the early 1990s. They asked themselves two questions. One, what's the most exploited form of wildlife of the moment? And the answer they came back with was reptiles. In the early 1990s, owing to the designer reptile movement and some other factors, the price of rare reptiles was through the roof, and smuggling was off the charts. And they had just finished an investigation on rare bird smugglers, as you're familiar with, called Operation Renegade, and a couple of others that really did some good work in terms of stopping illegal bird trafficking. They decided they were going to move to reptiles, and then they asked themselves, who's the worst in the world on reptile smuggling? And the answer they came up with was a man in Malaysia named Anson Wong. And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has an elite undercover unit called Special Operations. Special Operations focuses on long-term undercover investigations, and they made Anson Wong their focus. So I had heard about that case. That case was successful in terms of eventually getting Anson and sending him to prison. He went to prison for 70, or he was sentenced to 71 months in prison. And Anson was a customer and a supplier and part of the Strictly Reptiles reptile smuggling syndicate. So when I wrote The Lizard King, there was a strong overlap with Anson, and I included a chapter on his smuggling. But I felt like I hadn't told the whole story. I knew that Anson did far more than reptiles, and I knew that he was out of prison, and from working at Strictly Reptiles, I had unpacked shipments from Anson, so I knew he was very much in business, and I was very curious about what Anson might be doing today, and I knew that he had in the past offered snow leopards for sale, or snow leopard pelts and panda bear skins that he had offered to traffic in rhino horn. All the sorts of species we think about as the most critically endangered on the planet, Anson smuggled because they were critically endangered. And he made it his specialty to poach and traffic the most vulnerable on the planet. And no one had addressed that. He had not, none of that had come up in his criminal trial, and no one had exposed that. And so I wanted to see if I could tell that story. And then it seemed unbelievable to me that he could operate as long as he had, as consistently as he had, without any problem from the Malaysian law enforcement. And so that suggested to me that he might have a friend in the Malaysian government that was protecting him. And so the second part of the National Geographic story was, does he have a connection to his own government? And who is that person, and can we name them? And that, in many ways, that's the bigger story. there's always bad guys out there, but those bad guys often can't operate year after year without government complicity or government complacency. And in this case, the government official who is in charge of monitoring Anson told me that Anson was her good friend and had been for years, and went on to detail the sort of relationship they have. And I leave it to readers to judge.
It's an amazing story, and I'm wondering, and again, it's the January 2010 issue of National Geographic, and I'm wondering what the reaction has been in Malaysia, both for your book and also vis-a-vis this article, because I know you've been to Malaysia and spoken there, and it seems that there have been a number of impacts from both your book and the article. If you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure, yeah. The book got a phenomenal reception. It was front page of the major newspapers there, and I went over. I've been to Malaysia a number of times now, and all the major newspapers covered my visit, and I was on sort of Regis and Kelly show version, Malaysian version, and the radio, the top radio programs and things. It was really, if you could be a rock star, writing about reptile smuggling, that was my moment. And it was really terrific. And that was, and I, of course, didn't tell anybody. I was still working on what would become the National Geographic piece. And that piece came out in January, and within 2 weeks of it coming out, the Minister of Environment stripped the department that I exposed in the story, stripped it of its authority to issue the kinds of permits that Anson Wong uses to get rare animals like the tiger, and made some other changes immediately. That,
oh, really? That's amazing.
Yeah, it was very satisfying on the one hand, and if you didn't know anything about Malaysia or politics in general, you'd be very satisfied. But the proof is in the pudding, really, and I suspect that over time, we're going to see that players who want to can continue to manipulate the system and continue to run their businesses. But for now, I'm told that Anson's efforts to open a new zoo that would focus on tigers and a business that would focus on big cats has been stopped, and that he can't get the permits he needs to do it. It wasn't just my story. My story may have been the triggering event in terms of publicity, but there have been some local reporters working on the story of wildlife trade and Malaysia's role as a hub for a few years, and there have been some NGOs that have been putting some pressure, not enough in my opinion, but some pressure on the government for a number of years.
So how does the law work in Malaysia? What's legal and what's illegal?
They actually have a long list of things that are, they call it totally protected, which sounds like a Valley Girl reference to wildlife. And it took me a while to think. People would say, that's a totally protected species. And I would, as a lawyer, I just thought that was strange, but it's a term of art, meaning completely protected species, where you're not allowed to have any commercial trade of that animal or commercial dealing with that species. And they have a good long list in general. But if you're granted a special permit by the government, you're allowed to possess that wildlife. Still, you're not supposed to commercially trade it. The fact is, people get special permits and then do trade that wildlife, technically illegally, but once you have the permit, it's very hard to monitor what your animal breeds and what dies, and people shuffle them around like it's a bit of a shell game.
And are the permits grandfathered as well. So anybody, if somebody had been issued a permit previously, could they still operate despite this new change in the Wildlife Department not being able to issue permits?
That's a good question. I think there is. I don't think you have an indefinite right. I don't know if they're reissued annually, but Anson had special permits in the past, for example, and now he's having trouble getting some of the ones he wants. So I'm not sure if they're reissued annually. Or at what time interval, but I don't think they run in perpetuity.
You talked about Anson really shifting, or maybe he hasn't shifted, but from reptiles to even more rare species like the snow leopards, like rhinos, like tigers. How did you uncover that?
Two aspects. One is, unlike wildlife dealers in the United States who tend to specialize, so reptile people are reptile people and big cat people are big cat. Overseas, wildlife dealers are opportunistic feeders or generalists. So during the 90s, Anson was talking about being able to provide snow leopards and pandas and things. What I discovered, I went to see him as part of the National Geographic story, and he had just been approved the day before to open a new zoo on the island of Penang, which is a little island off the west coast of Malaysia, and where it's where he lives. And so he slid the blueprints over to me, and he started telling me about what he intended to have at the zoo. And the point he really underscored was, I'm known as a reptile person, but I am moving to big cats. Cats are going to be my priority, and tigers in particular. And knowing what I did about Anson's history, while he was smuggling back in the 90s, he also had a zoo on Penang, and many people who visited Penang had been to that zoo, not knowing that the same guy who owns that is the world's biggest wildlife trafficker. And Anson's partner at that zoo is one of the world's leading orchid authorities and well respected in the orchid world. And people have no idea about that. And so the story for National Geographic spent a lot of, I spent a lot of time looking at Anson's assets and different companies he owns, and he owns a number of them. And it was quite eye-opening for me.
And then, what is the law regarding, just in general, internationally, with the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, with zoos, or being able to have a zoo like that with big cats? Is that legal? Is that illegal?
That's one reason to have a zoo, is you can get a. CITES is the convention you refer to on endangered species trade, and it's designed in general to regulate animals, the trade of animals, based on how endangered they are, so that tigers you're not allowed to trade, and iguanas you can trade in certain quantities and things like that. But if you're a zoo, you get a pass, and it's one reason people open zoos. Is to mask or to facilitate their illegal trade in wildlife.
And we're not talking about zoos like the, accredited zoos like the Bronx Zoo, or Brookfield Zoo, but sort of private, more private types of zoos.
That's true, although, in The Lizard King, I tell the story of the role of some of the biggest zoos in the United States in getting smuggling off the ground, so that the Smithsonian, the National Zoo there in Washington, D.C., was connected to a major international smuggler who was buying animals from him, went the allegations. Dallas Zoo was connected to that case. The Bronx Zoo ordered lemurs from him. This is back in the 70s and 80s. But zoos are not uniform. You can't generalize that they're bad or that they're good, but there are the same avarice, the same I've got to have it that afflicts individuals, afflicts zookeepers. And so zoos, yes, what I'm talking about in the case of setting up fake stuff is private zoos generally that are government accredited by the national government. But I don't want to give a complete pass to the more well-known zoos either.
That's really interesting. Well, I appreciate your taking the time to
Oh, it's
talk
my
with
great
me.
pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed those insights into the illegal reptile trade with Brian Christie, author of The Lizard King and also the January 2010 article in National Geographic called The Kingpin on Asia's Wildlife Trade. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. This week's creature call is an endangered reptile that comes from Indonesia. It's the largest living species of lizard, which can grow up to 10 feet in length. Here's your creature call. For next week's creature call, we'll move to sub-Saharan Africa, and I'll play the sound of a large semi-aquatic herbivorous mammal. Here's your preview. Be sure to tune in next week when I'll replay this strange sound from the wild world and reveal the animal that made it. Next week, I'll also talk with Christian Teleki, Vice President for Science Initiatives for SeaWeb, and also former Director of the International Coral Reef Action Network, a unique global partnership dedicated to addressing the serious decline in the health of the world's coral reefs. We'll talk about the biology of corals, threats to coral reefs, and what can be done to halt their decline. Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnimi.com, and at laurelnimi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnimi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. The Wildlife is also brought to you in part by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world. Internet, television, telephone, burlingtontelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic network. Now, here's a public service announcement from Wildlife Friendly. Certified Wildlife Friendly is a global community whose mission is to protect wildlife in wild places while supporting the enterprises of the people who coexist with wildlife and who are working to protect their habitat. When you buy Wildlife Friendly, you are helping to save the most endangered wildlife in the world while helping some of the poorest communities in the most magnificent places left on Earth. Certified wildlife-friendly products and services support the triple bottom line of people, planet, and profits. More information is available at www.wildlifefriendly.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.